welcome to Remainders.
Welcome to Remainders in November of 2022. My gosh, man, it's been about 2 years since we've been doing this podcast. Can you believe it?
I definitely can, because it's definitely been a highlight of a COVID world. So,
absolutely. Yeah, it's kind of like the marker, right? We knew like during COVID we started this, so you can't forget that.
Yeah, I was actually just talking about this the other day, how this started as a project coming out of COVID. You know, our limited options for what to do with ourselves under lockdown. And it's definitely been the highlight of coming out of that. So definitely very happy for it. So it's good to see you, man. You're looking very svelte today.
Yeah.
Got some new artwork. Always looking good as always.
I'm great. Thank you for asking. And thanks for always giving me those compliments. You know, I'm going to walk around with my head held high every time we do. But you as well. And I thought maybe I'd be seeing like just a mustache or like something different with the beard. I mention it every time, because if you're not looking at us and you're just listening to us, Pat has this like really wicked cool beard, which is the topic of a lot of conversation there online when people talk about our show. Believe it or not, people really love the beard. And I think you said you were going to do something different with the mustache. So before I talk about me, are you growing out the mustache bigger than the beard? What's the deal with that?
Well, I mean, I've been intrigued with the idea of a beard stash, where it's like, you know, like a full mustache with like full stubble. So like this would get all cut off, but the mustache would stay. You know, I mean, since we're talking movies, Henry Cavill in Mission Impossible is maybe the best beard stash of all time. I mean, that's like the apex of it. If you haven't seen that one, I would highly recommend Googling beard stash with Henry Cavill from Mission Impossible, because it is top tier in terms of male facial hair. And I'm thinking about it. I don't know. Like, I'm so fucking lazy. That's why I have a beard, because I don't even touch the beard myself anymore. It's just like whenever I get my hair cut, my barber, Bo, he just takes care of the beard, and I'm pretty much good for 2 months straight. So it's really out of laziness. So,
I mean, you say you're lazy all the time, but you're the one who's pushing me always to do this podcast. So I can't believe you anymore. I think that you actually have a little pep in your step, and you like to get shit done these days. So, but I'm glad for it, because I need that push lately with how busy I've been. And this is like the breath of fresh air. So hopefully everybody listening, everybody watching feels the same when it comes to Remainders. Hopefully you feel that good vibe that we feel whenever we get to talk to each other. Thank you for the update on the beard stash. I really didn't know what it was when you mentioned it, but I can kind of see it kind of like becoming bigger up in the stash area. So I'm interested to see where we go by next time. Maybe that'll be growing, and you know, people can see firsthand what a beard stash looks like on Patrick McIntyre.
But I have not seen these comments that you speak of online commenting on my beard, and
because they're all in my DMs.
Okay, I was gonna say, I just wanted to be sure. It's like I was like, I'm not like trolling our stuff for like comments, but like I definitely haven't seen that, and I'm probably not interested in it, because it'd probably give me an ego or something. So unless they're shitting on the beard, I don't know.
No, and people love it. I mean, my girlfriend and I talk about it a lot. She's like, yeah, beard's looking good. But anyway, you asked how I'm feeling. I'm feeling good. Feel great today. I mean, the word of the day for me is freedom. I feel free. Oh. We actually delivered that documentary that I was talking about, that I was working on, that was taking up so much of my time. So I feel really free today on this Friday. I finished all of my prints. So anybody who's not watching, if you look at it, you can see I've been dropping a print a day. And I just wanted to show these because it's relevant to the podcast. So here's my Warren Zevon. We both love Warren Zevon, Pat and I, and I painted Warren Zevon, and I got a official print. I haven't dropped this one yet, but I thought I'd show it because of, you know, our equal love for Warren Zevon.
Put me down for the first copy of that one. I have a couple of friends and family who definitely want that one. So,
well, for sure. Yeah. I know. I felt like I should just not even show you and just send it to you as a present. But, there we go. And then this one.
Yeah, this one
has been out, and I have actually some greeting cards with the music box on there. But we talk about the music box. because it's one of the premier wonderful theaters in the world, not just in Chicago, and Pat goes all the time. If you missed our last episode where he talked about sleeping there for pretty much 24 hours while he watched horror movies, go back and listen to that. And then, you know, just a little Tarantino love with him creating his characters. So.
Look at that. That is amazing. Wait, yep. Pull that one up again. I saw the other two before. Let me see. I'm seeing this one for the first time. Oh, wow. This is great. I love it.
Yeah. This one has to do with like kind of, building clay. So if you're not, again, if you're listening and not watching, he's Tarantino's building his characters out of clay. I love that idea that he just out of his mind, he kind of builds these great characters that we all get to enjoy and love and talk about on our podcasts.
Hell yeah. Yeah. So I got his book, Cinema Speculation, in the mail the day it came out. I haven't opened it yet. I haven't had a chance to dive in yet. I'm hoping within the next week, but definitely very excited. I've been hearing great things about that one. So I was I showed you this one, but this is what I've been reading all week. Blood, Sweat, and Chrome by Kyle Buchanan, which is this fantastic oral history of one of my favorite movies, Mad Max Fury Road. Wild fucking story about this movie. Even if like you're okay on the movie, this is a great book to pick up on the filmmaking process. I mean, they started, George Miller tried to get that movie off the ground beginning in like 1995, I think officially is when like the first meetings took place trying to get Fury Road off the ground. And so a full 20 years from start to finish for that movie. Yeah. And it's because just so many different things kind of came into play, and it was obviously hit such an ambitious movie. For anybody who's seen it, they definitely understand because everything was just so tactile, no CGI whatsoever. But yeah, highly recommend it. So I'm sure we'll talk more about it. I would not be surprised if we get to that movie on this podcast one day.
We have to, because I'm kind of waiting to see it. I've never seen that film, right? I've never seen Mad Max Fury Road.
I did not know that, and you're blowing my mind right now. That's okay. I mean, I am excited for it then. That's fantastic. No, I had no idea you had not seen it. So now I'm even more excited to cover it.
Well, that's why it's kind of crazy when you show me that there's a book out about Mad Max Fury Road. I every time you talk about how much you love it, you know, I've been meaning to see it. I figured we'd cover it on Remainders, but at the same time, I didn't know like that it was 20 years in the making, that there's a full book. I mean, that book's pretty thick. There's got to be a lot to talk about that. And that,
yeah, you know, I mean, it is one of the rare kind of a niche movie that actually broke into the mainstream. I mean, it is like a B movie that was nominated for Best Picture. So it's just it just kind of transcends high art and low art. You've seen the original
Mad Max of course. Well, that's the thing, Mad Max is in the title, so I figured, you know, it's got to have something to do with that universe.
Oh, it's definitely the same. It's the continuation of the story, but obviously goes in a very different direction. We'll save it for another day. I love that movie, and now I'm even more excited to talk about it with you. So
yeah, for sure. Well, and as a segue, I did, you know, we're going to do something new on Remainders. I think we're going to talk about some music that we like at the end. Maybe we'll save that for the end so we can kind of like throw our picks of like what we're listening to right now. Is that cool with you? Or do you want to, because I'd like to get into Night of the Hunter to be able to like, you know, get into our movie we're covering today, which is Night of the Hunter, which is another movie I had not seen up until last night when I watched it, and it's Pat's recommendation. And then later on, we will cover a couple of the songs or one song that we're listening to that we're going to recommend to you until next week, right?
Yeah. I mean, this podcast is about film, but Darren and I have been talking music just about as much for the last 20 years. So I think it would be only appropriate to kind of check in to see what's getting sounding good in our ears lately. So
definitely I wanted to make sure people knew to stick around till the end to hear our picks of what we're going to do, because I think that's a cool new addition to the podcast, since we love everything, not just movies but also music. And I thought about that all week while we were getting ready to do this, what would I pick for my song. So I've got one, and I'm excited to talk to you about that after we talk about Night of the Hunter, starring Robert Mitchum, who's fucking insanely good in this film. Wow. Thanks for recommending it. It's a bunch of things that I didn't think it was going to be. One, a pick that you'd pick, because it is an older film in, you know, classic Hollywood times, let's say. And then also, as I was reading up about it, Charles Laughton had put a lot of his love of silent film in here. And we had just talked about Haxan and different things about silent film. So I'm excited to dig into all this. What, it's your pick. Can you talk a little bit about why you chose this film?
Yeah, I mean, so I saw this movie maybe for the first time, possibly a decade ago. I think it was just in a process of digging into the more popular older movies. So a lot of just basic Googling the best of list of all time. And I remember, I think it was Empire, the magazine, if I'm remembering correctly, they had it like fairly high in like one of their best movies of all time. And at the time I had never heard of it. I checked it out. I actually got, it was also a recommendation from my uncle. He was a huge fan of Robert Mitchum. And he, the second I brought it up to him, I don't think he'd ever spoken about it before to me, but like the second I brought it up to him, he's like, oh, you got to watch that movie. Absolute classic from the 50s. One of the best movies of that decade. And so that's when I first checked it out. I think that's when I bought the Criterion Edition, because it had just recently been released. I'm going off of memory at the time, but I did watch it on that copy that I've had for many years now. So very excited for that. One of the few DVDs that I've actually maintained over the years. I did go through a giant purge of physical media. Unfortunately, I do a little bit regret it, but you know, it is what it is. But I've kept the essentials over the years, so that's definitely one of them. But yeah, I mean, it's essentially because this movie is almost a horror film. And as I mentioned, it was one of the openers to the Music Box of Horrors that went on a couple weeks ago at the Music Box. And I think a lot of people were, it was an unexpected pick for a lot of people to play with all like the other 70s grindhouse movies with all with the blood fun. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it was just kind of playing up against that type of film. And I thought it was like a perfect pick for that, because like with Mitchum's performance in this movie, it is almost a horror film. And also it being a one-off from Charles Laughton, who I'm sure you know much more than I do. I know him from Witness for the Prosecution and obviously The Hunchback of Notre Dame, but I think those are the only two movies that I've really ever seen him in. And I'm sure you could probably enlighten me a little bit more on what else, but the fact that he was such a well-respected actor and then his one and only film in 1955, his first film is basically a perfect film that people revere still to today. And it was just one and done for him. And we can get into it. It sounds like it wasn't entirely up to him that he chose to stop, but the fact that this movie wasn't necessarily received well when it first came out, it was part of the reason why he hung up his reins as a film director.
Yeah, you know, I love that story of like how you kind of got to this film. It's not like I love Robert Mitchum. I mean, everything I've ever seen him in is great, but it's something about Robert Mitchum. It's like one of those actors where I don't like gravitate. Like I want to watch a film with Robert Mitchum in it. You know what I mean? Like yeah. The Criterion just had like 20 films of Robert Mitchum a couple months ago. And I was like, oh, this is going to be great. But for some reason, I don't just like want to watch those movies. He's like, he's such like, I don't give a fuck actor. And he's such like a style, just like all those actors were back there. That he gives off this like persona that's so big that it almost overtakes the films for me. In this case, I think it's just has to be that way. Well, the casting for him is like, it is in Cape Fear. Like, what the fuck? Like, get out of this guy's way. And he's cruel and conniving and manipulative and misogynistic. And, you know, anybody who is portraying a preacher who's, you know, really a serial killer at the end of the day, is frightening. I can understand why he's open with that. That's terrifying. He's coming after little kids basically throughout the entire film. Speaking of Laughton, we can talk about why he only chose one. And I think that's a bigger conversation, but for right now, my understanding of him was actually very minimal. I knew about him, of course, but it was in a time period, and especially when it gets to like films made in, you know, London actors or like stage actors from back then. I don't know too much about that. Mm. And I remember walking into Forest Lawn, like the second Forest Lawn out here, cemetery. There's an area that has like Ronnie James Dio up there. And there's like Debbie Reynolds and Carrie Fisher. And then like a bunch of actors and actresses. It opens up with like, there's a lot of older actors and actresses buried up there. And I came across one time in the crypt, Charles Laughton. And I remember thinking, I know Charles Laughton, but I don't know too much of like what he's done. I stopped there for a second and just like kind of like thought about it. Do I know Charles Laughton's work? And I watched this film. And as soon as I saw that name up there, I was like, fucking Night of the Hunter, Charles Laughton. This is where, like, I've heard it for years. Okay, you know, this guy directed this film, but for whatever reason, I had never seen this film. And I'm so excited to talk about it because I loved it. I mean, it was set, like, knowing him, Charles Laughton, as a stage actor, you can see that portrayed in so much. A lot of scenes look like a set. I mean, they look like a stage. Yeah. Set. And I think because they were, of course, but I think it was also intentional that the design was like that from what I heard of what I've read of his perspective. He wanted it to feel like that. He also studied a lot of silent films, and even like Lillian Gish, who's in this. She's like a silent film actress. And he asked a lot about, you know, things that they did back then. And, you know, there was a quote, I think, in the Wikipedia that I read, that he talked about how people would be on the edge of their seat leaning forward. But nowadays, in like the 50s, people were more slumped, eating popcorn, not really caring. I mean, can you imagine if you lived to see how people watch movies now, like with their phones and shit like that, 80 things going on at the same time. But when I read that, it kind of made sense. He wanted to make this film that people could like pay attention to and be on the edge of their seat more. And then also the understanding of silent film. There's so many like iris ins shots and different things that, you know, were part of the aesthetic of silent films, and like, you know, more shadow work, a lot of things that aren't said. You know, the use of song in this, we can talk about. I mean, there's so much going on. It was definitely something you watch for the first time, and then visually it's striking. So Charles Laughton, to get kind of like shit on because it wasn't very well received back in the day, just like Hitchcock with Vertigo. And now it's, revered as one of the top five movies of all time by so many people. And so is this film, from what I've read. It's unfair, as any artist, that they can't appreciate it and have it appreciated in their time, right?
Oh, totally. Okay, yeah. I mean, speaking from the aesthetic point of view, I mean, I think that's why it like resonated with me so instantly when I saw it like 10 years ago, is the visual component. And that makes sense. Like, obviously at the time I had no idea that he was like harkening back to silent film era, but it really was like the sets and the, as you said, kind of the almost fake looking sets, but like creating a theatrics to it. I was just leafing through the booklet for the Criterion, and they mentioned a few scenes hearkening to the cabinet of Dr. Caligari, which is a pretty pivotal movie for me, actually. I saw that at a very young age. I believe my aunt brought me to a silent screening of that when I was like 8 or 9. It was at the University of Chicago here in Chicago, in the cathedral where I ended up actually graduating from, getting my diploma, just by coincidence. And it was a silent screening of that with a live organ, the cabinet of Dr. Caligari. And just seeing that at such a young age, I was like, what the fuck is going on? Like, it was so unlike anything I'd ever seen before. And it's certainly a reason why a horror has always been one of my favorite genres, just having that implanted in my mind at a young age. And,
maybe so if just... anybody hasn't seen that film, the reason I think you're saying you really liked it, because it is like the set design and things like that are so obscure. And so it's right. not just the subject matter. It's about visually what's taking place in that film, right?
Entirely visually. I mean, I'm sure I didn't understand half of what was actually happening when I was watching it when I was 8 or 9, but like seeing the sets and I mean, so I was 8 or 9. So it was like, this is like the same year I was watching Jurassic Park or Tremors. So those movies going together at the same time. Definitely a good mix. I mean, kind of dovetailing to my controversial pick of Halloween 2 from Rob Zombie as being my second favorite Halloween movie of all time, which apparently ruffled a few feathers with that pick. I mean, so his favorite movie of all time is easily The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. He, like, his video for Living Dead Girl is...
You mean Rob Zombie?
Yeah, like, yeah. That's one of his favorite movies of all time. And visually, one of his biggest inspirations, like his music video for Living Dead Girl is a complete remake of that movie. And so I watched this movie the night after watching Halloween 2, Rob Zombie's. And they definitely go well together. We'll just say that. Like, obviously, I'm not comparing the two, but there is the surrealism, the heightened reality. I mean, one of the first shots in this movie are like the floating heads of the children.
Yeah.
As the woman talking. I mean, that's like straight out of like what Zombie was trying to do with that second one, just the heightened surrealism of seeing the dead figures in Michael Myers' past. So definitely very much was responded well. It definitely went well together watching those two back-to-back.
Yeah, super interesting. I guess I never really knew that. So now I'm like even more ingrained in how much I love Halloween 2 by Rob Zombie, because I want to like watch and like see the references. I mean, we talked about it on that episode that he just gets horror, you know, and yeah. He gets that stuff. And that's why I love him so much. I mean, if you take away all, you know, it's not the original and they go in the backstory, all that crap, like just his knowledge of horror films. I think you can get on board with like, he really pays a lot of great tribute to the masters from before, the greats before.
Totally. Yeah.
And like Charles Laughton getting in this and a lot of the set design that we talked about, I had read too that he did want to have some of those obscure, like even if it is a barn or whatever, like you're seeing, they wanted it to look like that Cabinet of Caligari, like all of those German expressionist films right. that had that sort of like, there's something obscure about this like look, like it's not necessarily... like you said, I guess the best word is like surrealism, you know, you want it to feel a little surreal, like even the sky in the background, it's like, those aren't real stars, you could tell, but like, it's got that really like, kind of like dreamlike feel, you know, and this is a nightmare. It's like kids are on the river trying to get away. I mean, that scene with him and they're getting through the mud to get like the boat out of the way. And here comes Robert Mitchum and he yeah. falls and you're like, oh my God, like this guy's going to get him, you know, like he's going to get these kids. Man, there were some moments in this that I just loved like that.
That leads to one of my favorite scenes in the movie is when they do get away on the boat. It's basically a Grimm's fairy tale at that time with the kids running away by an adult trying to kill them. And Pearl, the girl, it's John and Pearl, the two kids, Pearl starts just singing a song. She's just playing with her doll and she just starts singing a song. It's like this fairy tale song. And then it's showing different shots as they're tracking them going down the river. And they have this one with the spider web in the background with her singing. Yeah. And it was like, yeah, this is, I remember at that point, like when I was first watching it for the first time 10 years ago, I was like, no, this movie's one of the best out there. So that shot alone did it for me. And it was so great to see that again. And obviously just understanding it in more depth now. So,
yeah, I think in that interview that you sent me that Guillermo del Toro did, I don't always agree with Guillermo del Toro, by the way, because I know he loved Under the Silver Lake, and I didn't really love that. So, but I will say this is.
Oh, he liked it? I didn't know he was.
He like tweeted it out the other day or something.
Hey, he's got great taste.
Well, you can go back and listen to why I didn't really necessarily love it in our episode on Under the Silver Lake. But anyway, he had something kind of interesting to say about like what you were mentioning in this film and like the happiness, but with the horror.
Yeah.
And that little girl is just like the epitome of innocence, right? You know, she has this secret that she doesn't really know anything about. Like, so for anybody who doesn't know the story, there are going to be some spoilers here, but her father, there's two kids that are on the run from Robert Mitchum. We didn't really set up the story too much yet. They are, in the beginning of the movie, important characters because their father has robbed and stolen money and then gets caught by the police and ultimately gets hanged. But before he gets caught, he tells his kids where the money is hidden, which is a lot of money that's going to secure their future. And so the father does this because he wants to help the kids. Like, that's, you know, they're down on and not doing so well. And that's his main purpose. So don't get kids here. It's safe for you later on. Don't tell anybody. Goes, dies, meets Robert Mitchum before he dies in prison. And Robert Mitchum is just this terrible, terrible, terrible character. The epitome of the scum of the earth, serial killer. He's trying to find out where the money is hidden, but finds out that, you know, it is there, it's hidden. And when he leaves jail, decides to pretend that he's a preacher and totally bamboozle the entire town as like, I'm this great character here, and I'm marrying this sinner's wife. But really behind it all, he wants to find out where the money is. And so for anybody, that's the plot of this movie. And then Robert Mitchum is basically like the pseudo dad to these kids, and what happens with the wife and him, he's all playing them so that he can get this cash. He needs to find out where it is. And that is terrifying in general. Like, nobody thinks that this guy's a bad guy. Nobody has a clue. And he's just here ready to unleash havoc on anybody who comes into his path.
That's his MO. This was in a world where before you could the idea of being a man of God being evil was unheard of, and it's a little bit of a flipped world now. So I mean that's definitely his strategy in life, is to pose as the preacher. And we open up on him driving, and he's like talking to God, and he's like saying, like, he's talking about his victims. It's like, how many housewives has it been? 6, 7? And so this man, like, they just straight up set him up as talking to God about all the women that he's already robbed and murdered in the past.
Right. And you kind of think, like, he probably does think he's some sort of like servant of God. Like, you know, that's the scary part about it.
That's what I was thinking about a lot with this time around, because I had never, in the past I'd always been like, it's almost 100% bullshit, but at the same time he is 100% by himself still speaking to God, and so right. To a certain degree he probably is believing it to a certain extent of his own bullshit,
right? No one's around to play the character, so at that point you really realize like this guy is pretty fucked up mentally to be able to be having this conversation with God about the people that he's killed.
Well, he was just creating the original method actor. Mitchum wasn't method acting, but he created an actor, a character who was method acting, maybe. So,
yeah, right.
I mean, the setup for this movie is like so simple, but hangs on Mitchum's performance, which, like I was saying before, is just one of the best parts of the movie because of how much of a terrifying character he is.
Oh yeah.
So Ben Harper, I realized, watched this, is the actor Peter Graves, who was the pilot from Airplane, which kind of blew my mind when I saw that.
Really? Yeah. That's great.
He's like the original pilot who gets sick. He's piloting with Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
We could talk about Shelley Winters, of course, who went on to be like that Lamb Chop. She was on like that Lamb Chop show, that children's show later on. But she was also in A Place in the Sun.
Is that her? Oh, she was? Okay, I didn't realize that. Yeah, all right. Yeah, nice.
No, some great actors in this. We talked about it before, anybody who's listening to this podcast knows that I love Jim Jarmusch very much. And his last role was in a Jim Jarmusch film, Dead Man.
Hell yeah.
And he's fucking frightening in that as well.
Yeah, right.
Great actor. I think he was like so much...
Johnny Depp.
Yeah, and I think he was so much... who you saw on screen was who you saw in real life with Robert Mitchum. Like, I think he maybe was even more terrifying in real life than he was on screen.
Yeah. Right.
Commanding presence of I don't give a fuck.
So I've only seen, I mean, I've seen Scorsese's Cape Fear like 15 times, but I've only seen the original once.
Yeah.
And a long time ago. So I probably should watch it again.
Man, he's great in that too. I mean, yeah. Reversing the roles, right? So,
right. Yeah, yeah.
I believe he plays like the detective in that, right? Richard. Yep. And
He's got that great delivery to Nick Nolte when he slides him off. He's like, "Well, I don't need your fucking help." And Mitchum's just like, "Well, pardon me, all over the place."
Yeah, all over the place. This is so good. I love so it. Good. And then also Gregory Peck, who also was in the original Cape Fear, killing it as that Southern lawyer scene. Oh man, I will. The original Cape Fear is great. It's amazing. I love it. Scorsese's is better. I have to side on. I mean, I don't know how you compare. I mean, they're both fucking awesome movies.
You don't have to compare, but yeah, I'll take Scorsese's movie for sure.
This movie reminded me of Cape Fear. Just like the diabolicalness of it all. That's the, I think, the great word about Mitchum's performance in Night of the Hunter is he's diabolical. I mean, he's talking to God, like, you know,
yeah.
Going to get killing some children to get some money. He, spoiler alert, he kills the wife that he married. He married her and then puts her in the bottom of the lake. And talk about beautiful. Like, that's, man, like, that scene is insanely beautiful. And she's at the bottom of the lake, you know?
Yeah, and Del Toro was saved. Like, I've been trying to create a shot like that for 25 years now because that's how much he loved it. And that is the type of shot where, like you were saying, finding the beauty in horror. And so it just visually just represents the film so perfectly because, like, the way with the willows are, like, going in the water and then it just pans over to her dead body. You can see it's, like, strapped in the car. And then her hair going into the water, and it's such a great transition of showing this horror.
I mean, it's a work of art. That's the thing. It's like people like are taking their time back then to like think about how this is going to be portrayed psychologically, theatrically, visually. It's a pivotal scene and like full execution. Like all these years later, it's amazing. So we should just break this open right now. The reason that Charles Laughton only did one film, from what I understand, is this bombed. This film bombed back in the day. And that's why I said with like Vertigo bombed, but now it's like, you know, with Citizen Kane, it's always like, is Citizen Kane or Vertigo the best movie of all time? I know you pick Mad Max Fury Road or RoboCop, but you know, you get it. Like on most people's top 10 lists, they have Vertigo or Citizen Kane. And this is very high on the list too. But it didn't act that way at first. So why do you think that is? Why do you think it's grown so much?
Well, it's grown so much because it's fucking great. But I think it bombs. I mean, who knows? But what I'm thinking about right now is the fact that it was a movie where you could clearly see him criticizing religion and organized religion. I mean, that's what Robert Mitchum's like tool for evil is in this movie, is posing as a religious man, using religion to trick people and him profiting from it. And this was in the 50s. This was well before our time. And criticizing the church was just a far more of an unheard of and of an act that people just wouldn't tolerate. You would be ostracized from every channel of getting your criticism through, and people just wouldn't have it at the time. And so I think that probably had a decent component of why it kind of got ignored. I can imagine a lot of the critics at the time being like, yeah, there's some inventive stuff in here, but I don't like what he's saying about God. And I could see that being a part of it. But who knows? I mean, I could definitely do my own research and kind of see what the original reviews were saying about it. But again, nobody at the time would be kind of really saying that overtly. They're just like, well, he's criticizing my God or making a note about religion and how it's not the the goodness that it's supposed to be. And so I'm just going to dismiss it. So, and I could see a lot of the audience kind of having that same reaction too. So,
yeah. I mean, in my view, I think there's also the component of like the movie going experience, you know. I mean, I think that's easy to say nowadays, but meaning, you know, you got maybe a trailer back then that you saw somewhere, but that's really all you got. Like you'd have to read the newspaper about it or whatever to kind of understand what you're going to see. And so nowadays, you know, you can practically watch the movie before it's in the theater, like somehow online, you know, or yeah. Like you get at least like a lot more snippets and a lot more information to ingest before you go to see a movie and make the decision to spend your movie. Half the time people don't even go to the theater anyway, they're buying it at home and renting it there. So I think, you know, over time, this movie got out on probably VHS, you know, or whatever, and then Laserdisc, or and it grew its audience based on a lot more people were able to watch it, and times had changed. So I think over time, that makes sense that this movie would. But it has to be said, and I think it's important to say for most artists, and I use this film to talk about this with my girlfriend today, like so many people who are fearless in art, I think you have to just, you can't worry so much about the reception at the time. If you have something to say and there's something really beautiful that you want to do, you have to do it, because like the way that it lives is not up to you. It's really not up to you. You know, you can't be the person following the trends. I mean, I suppose if you want to get a quick dollar in your pocket, that's a good way to do it, right? Like, oh, something is like, I don't know, let's just say emo's back, so I better write an emo song because that's what's hitting right now. Well, like, fine, but over time, like, you're not being your true self as an artist. And, you know, that's why I've read a lot about this film and how much, you know, they put into making this film in a specific way. I think it goes to show that's why it's so successful today and why it stands the test of time and why it's on so many people's top 10 lists, is because it wasn't compromised the way a lot of people do these days.
Yeah, no, yeah. I mean, I fully agree with that. I mean, it is, again, it is a surrealist, close to a surrealist film, and you know that's always a hard sell anyway for a general audience. But yeah, growing in cult status, I definitely think it benefits from the fact that it was Charles Laughton's only movie. Just is one and done. It's like a perfect record. It's just like basically hit a grand slam and just fucking walk to the bar to have a drink afterwards, and then that's
his. Well, he died in 62, so he probably never knew this was a grand slam, you know. Again, does, I don't know where we go after this, but nobody really knows for sure, but hopefully somewhere he knows he hit the grand slam in life, you know, with his, with his art at least.
Hell yeah. I mean, Stan, I mean, I mentioned it earlier, have you seen Witness for the Prosecution before?
I have not.
No. Okay. Billy Wilder movie with Tyrone Power and Marlene Dietrich. It's like a kind of a black comedy. It's a very, it's heavy plot. So I'm not going to give anything away about what it's really about, but it's kind of a murder mystery, and Charles Laughton plays a lawyer. And that's one of the few movies, like I said, that I've seen him in, and he's fucking great in it. So
definitely one to check out. Any Billy Wilder film anyway. That was just on the Criterion Billy Wilder, like five film retrospective, I think that they.
Oh, Witness was?
I think so. It may still be there. Yeah. So I'll check it out. I mean,
I saw that once like 15 years ago, and it still stuck with me. I haven't seen it since, but definitely would love to watch that.
Another one. Billy Wilder film like that is like Stalag 17. Have you ever seen that? I actually bought the DVD back in the day. It's great.
That one I've never seen. So.
It's like a war film, you know, about getting out of like a concentration camp, but it's fucking excellent. And I'd love to see that again. Just speaking of Billy Wilder, he's great. You know what's great about walking around the LACMA these days too?
What's that?
In LA. You can see these paintings that are up on the walls. And a lot of times, like when you read the inscription, I'm one of those guys who, like, you know, if you ever go to a museum with me, watch out, because I read all the inscriptions. I soak in everything.
I have time,
you know. But anyway, a lot of them are like famous actors or actresses collections who have their paintings in there. And a lot, I remember the last time I was there reading a lot of the inscriptions saying like gift of Billy Wilder, or gift, you know, a lot of, he's a big art collector. So yeah.
Oh, that's awesome. Love it.
Yeah, but this film is great, man. I'm glad you brought it to us. I mean, there's a lot to talk about in it. I just feel like it was kind of still soaking it in. You know, I saw it last night, and man, I'm like going to watch it again. And I think that, you know, Robert Mitchum at this point was like the 50, he's already a star. And he comes in and does this film. I think this is like something that was maybe one of the strongest performances I've ever seen of his. And it seems like this is like a little bit of like, you know, starting to get to mid-career for him.
I heard Lawton originally wanted Gary Cooper. Or that was the original name that was kind of leading. Well, apparently Lawton wanted to play the character himself. He wanted to play Powell. But the studios were like, no thanks. You could definitely direct it, but you're not going to star in it. And so Gary Cooper was a name that was attached to it for a while. But I guess he was hesitant to do it because it was such a psychopathic character that, I mean, Gary Cooper's definitely played bad guys, not many, but this one was a little bit too much for him. And so luckily it went to Mitchum, and I think it worked out for everybody there. But yeah, I mean, it's the love or hate. I mean, so I'm sure people, if you haven't seen the movie, it's got the love, hate on the knuckles. You maybe will be familiar with this image. And that is kind of really what ties it together for me so much of what that is. It's the light and the dark, but at the same time, using that faux dichotomy to trick people, essentially. You know, like he's like using this this idea that like there's only good or evil in the world. And so since I'm good, you should be trusting me. And it was really kind of reminded me of that Donnie Darko scene with Swayze and his self-help montage of, is it love or fear? Were those the two spectrums? I'm thinking
fear. Yeah. I can see the scene.
It's love. It's love and fear. That's the, there's that scene when Jonah Hall's in the class with the teacher, not Swayze, but like she's giving him the prompt of like finding the wallet and do you take the money or do you return it? And you have to basically choose. Is it this, does the kid who took the money, is he acting out of love or fear? And Jonah Hall's just like, I don't understand this. Like you can't just say everything's love or fear and then ignore everything else in life. And so that was definitely reminding me of that while I was watching it today, because it was, like I said, like there is, you know, there is the good and the beauty in all horror, and there is the yin and the yang of life. But at the same time, it's not that simple. And that's why Mitchum's character was able to like take advantage of so many people, because he's given that false dichotomy in a pro-religious world.
Well, you know, it happens all the time in business, right? You know, love to a lot of people is money. And so the business people know that they can take advantage of like the regular worker bees who just need the money, you know, and I can get you to do whatever I want you to do because I know that you need something that I have, which is the money. And that's a scary thing, because it's like the manipulation that goes on things like that, like love and money and those kind of things. And when people use it to get what they want, which is a lot of times very negative and dark stuff. That's pure, to me, that's pure evil, man. That's what evil is. And so that's why this is terrifying. This is why it's a terrifying movie. You know, he's got all of those components, and I don't think it can be stated enough. I mean, the family was in this position because the father wanted to, he was desperate and he had to steal this money to help his kids. Right. I mean, at the end of the day, he did something bad, but he was really doing it out of necessity, to not a Robin Hood thing to steal from the rich and give to the poor, but he was basically trying to help his kids get through and have a better life.
Yeah, that's something I was definitely noticing. So he's having his conversation near the beginning of the movie when he's in prison. That's when he first meets Robert Mitchum, with the great introduction to Mitchum when he like puts his head like upside down on the bunk. It's like such a great way to kind of give a comic
tinge. Something's off. Yeah,
exactly. And so he's talking about why he robbed the bank, and he's straight up saying it's like childhood poverty. I'm sick of seeing kids going starving. And yeah, he's probably not going to give the money, or at least all the money, to random children. And he's probably going to he's definitely doing it so his own children are secure. But at the same time, that was the clear impetus for his robbing the bank. It's like, I'm going insane seeing all this childhood poverty and all these children going hungry. So why not just rob a bank and make sure that a few children don't go starve? And then, so I love how that comes back in the scene after that terrifying wedding night scene when she comes in and tries to snuggle a little bit.
Consummate
the marriage. And he just completely humiliates her in that scene, making her look in the mirror and just showing that the chastity is what he's all about. But right after that, they cut to a scene where it's almost like a religious revival. And she's kind of atoning for her past sins. And she's talking about how it was my desire for makeup and perfume is what drove Ben Harper to steal that money. So it's like he obviously just coached her and just basically brainwashed her into making
manipulated her for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Manipulated her to and get everybody thinking that Ben Harper was stealing it completely for his own personal profit. And that definitely stuck out with me because it was such a complete reversal of what he was talking about.
Right. And that, again, that's the pure evil stuff, you know?
Yeah.
Oh man, I've seen that too many times in my life. And when you see, that's why some of these movies are hard to watch, you know, because you can relate to it on a personal level of the way that you've been treated or other people you've seen be treated. And that's why we connect to it, right? Because any of this stuff is relatable stuff, you know. It's that's why we are able to watch art or view art in our own unique lenses because of our own human experiences that we've had, you know.
Yeah, I'm just thinking of all the stuff I've consumed in the last year and how much I have related to it, which has been a lot.
Isn't that why, yeah. You know, entertainment is the forefront of why we want to watch films, you know. Of course, we want to be entertained. We want to have something fill our time that isn't, that can shut off stuff for a while. But in my life, and I feel like yours, you do both. You probably do the shut off stuff better than I do, but a lot of times I watch films like this and I bring out I related a lot more to the negative things in life and what it's trying to bring out and trying to caution, you know, the cautionary tales and some of the films that we watch. And so sometimes I watch these films and I leave it not being very entertained. It's not just for entertainment, but I leave it with oh shit, you know, that was actually maybe not good for me to watch because it's too close to home or whatever, you know?
No. Yeah. That's the shit I love the most. either hits close to home for me or for society. Art is, you know, real life through a prism, and it's far more entertaining to look at real life through a prism than it is to look at real life. That's essentially why I love it so much.
Watch a movie like Dumb and Dumber, which is kick ass and it's so funny and you enjoy it and you can really let it go for a night, you know. Instead I'll be the one who chooses Night of the Hunter, you know.
I mean, Night of the Hunter and Dumb and Dumber, it's a solid double feature I can get behind. it's the high art and the low art, which I shouldn't say that because I don't, you know, those can be one and the same. It's seeing how they complement each other. That's definitely what I'm all about for the double feature. So I would definitely be down for that double feature. So
you constantly surprise me on your picks, man. A lot of times, like I said, I'll not have seen the film and I'll kind of be like, okay, what's Pat like? Why is he like this film? Like this, especially, I wouldn't have thought that you'd choose. Not that I didn't think you'd like a film like this. I just didn't know that you loved it that much. You kept the DVD. This means something. This film obviously means something to you.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Definitely one of my favorites. That's maybe a conversation we can have for another time. But there's definitely my own taste varies wildly. And I've thought about this in the past and what I respond to and what I like. And it really is, I don't see a huge difference between a high art movie like Night of the Hunter and a low art movie like Dumb and Dumber. It's like they're just doing completely different things. So the idea that you would compare them is unnecessary completely. And it just really getting, as long as the movie's successful in what it's trying to do, then I completely think they go together.
I guess there's like one, there's like genres that you like gravitate towards more though, but you seem to be like able to listen, or I'm sorry, able to view kind of like anything, you know? And for me, whatever reason, I've talked about it before, like, I don't know, I don't really like gravitate towards watching war films or, you know, certain sort of like things that fit a genre. I'm like more like documentary films or like dramas, comedies, like maybe a close third, but not really. I wouldn't pick a comedy out over a drama, you know.
Well, yeah, comedy, that's a whole other discussion in just terms of how a comedy can be a completely terrible movie but be successful in being funny. You know, we're not talking like Woody Allen well-made comedies or anything. We're talking like, you know, basic stuff. That is just like, that's, I don't have an answer for that, but you can definitely make a terrible movie, but it's successful at being funny or something. But yeah, I mean, I have my ambivalent genres. I was just thinking about the other day, like I have to be dragged to watch most musicals. Like there have been so few musicals that I've like been able to get through. And it's definitely a blind spot for me, because I know there's plenty of amazing filmmaking in the past. I know particularly, I can think of ones that I know you love, that I've never really kind of gotten through. And that's just, that's showing my ignorance in being a versatile film consumer.
But I'm the same. It's not like I'm the like first guy to get in line to see a musical. Like if I hear a musical's coming, like it's even like La La Land. Like I love La La Land. I think that movie rules. I've heard a few people say that they don't like it and I kind of don't understand it, but it wasn't like, okay, I got to go watch this musical. Like, even now that I love it, it's not like the first movie I would pick, but I fucking love that movie. It's weird. It's like, there's something about, look, right. It's a specific thing, you know, you're getting into, like, you know, you're getting in for song and dance. And so, you know,
I mean, I can get behind Rocky Horror Picture Show. I saw the midnight showing last year and that was great. So
yeah,
I'm always down for that one. So
yeah.
Well, that's mostly because of Meatloaf. Meatloaf's amazing.
So have we explored Night of the Hunter and every aspect that you'd want to talk about it? I mean, I just want to tell people to go see it. If you hadn't, don't be like me. Don't be a dummy and spend your whole life not seeing this film. It's freaking amazing. One of the better picks that I have enjoyed of your picks. Not that anything has been bad, but this one really, like, I really was like, damn, I missed out on this for a long time, you know?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I just want to talk about closing it up. I mean, they get to the end and Lillian Gish is basically the savior. I think I saw it was written down. She's basically the avenger of the movie for all the women who are killed in the past from Robert Mitchum's character. She basically acts as like the redemption kind of Furiosa character, saving Grace and avenging these women. And so he gets taken down. And it really focuses on John and Pro spending their time with Lillian Gish now, and it's her focus on the resiliency of children at the end is just kind of what sticks out the most to me, and how she's basically just talking to John like you're able to cope with life far better than other people because you're a child, and children abide. I think it was the quote that she put into it. And that just definitely, I thought about that so many times before. It's just children have the ability to deal with life in a way that's better than adults. There's no feeling sorry for themselves. There's no falling into depression. I mean, children can experience depression, but you know, a child loses his legs, they're just gonna keep on living as a child, as opposed to an adult who may struggle with that substantially. And so that was really what kind of resonated a lot with me, is the resiliency of children is kind of what ties this movie together. And that's why there was so much focus on John and Pearl.
At the end, there's a scene where Lillian Gish, so for everybody listening and watching, she plays sort of like a, I don't know, like a, the main figure of like a sort of like a nanny figure that takes in children who are, I don't know, I guess lost or
more, it sounded like her own son stopped talking to her, and so she's just kind of responded to that by taking on other children who need
kind of straight protection. Children.
Yeah.
And it's not like she's like, you know, pulling a bunch of kids in. She's like,
no, not at all.
To know, like, who, you know, who their parents are and everything. She's just trying to help. And yeah, there's an interesting thing about her character and the juxtaposition of Robert Mitchum in that scene when he's like sitting outside and she's got the shotgun and she's on the porch and he's the big bad wolf ready to come in, right? And he's just sitting there taunting her by singing spiritual hymns, but she starts to sing along with him in unison. And that scene is unbelievable. Unbelievable how so well good. That's done.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that just definitely captures the good and the evil at the same time.
Yeah, and then when the kid comes in with the light and you see him like jet out, man, is that terrifying. Now you're like, where is he, you know?
Do you see him move? Like, yeah, she brings the light in.
But just a little bit.
Oh, you do see it. Okay, so so there's a scene, maybe setting it up if you haven't seen it, like she's in her room. You could see him outside through the window. Pearl comes in with a light. It almost looks like it just instantly gets the light turned on. And so you can't see him anymore because of the light. And then she turns the light off and then Mitchum is gone at the time. It's so well done. I fucking love
it. She was Lillian Gish's character is out there because she's trying to keep him, the big bad wolf, from getting into the house. And now nobody knows where he is and it's terrifying. The last thing I'll say in summation, and what you mentioned about, you know, children and everything, that it's around the holidays and so they're getting gifts, right? And it's kind of like a nice endearing moment that the main kid John is his name, right?
Yeah,
John. Kind of puts the apple together, even though it's like something that wasn't a gift really, it's just like an apple, and he gives it to her as like an offering. And so he's kind of like, but it's so innocent still, you know, he just wants her to feel good. And so he's giving her something, even though he doesn't really have any money to buy her anything. Lillian Gish's character I'm speaking about. And she, Lillian Gish's character, the nanny of the orphanage, or however you want to say it, gives him a watch. Do you know, like, I haven't really figured out the significance of that. Is that something you've thought about, or?
An overt significance? No. I think, I just kind of read it as his like official, entry into adulthood.
You know? Yeah, so that's kind of the only thing I could get from that. Like, is he sort of like becoming a man now, you know?
Right. I mean, that's how I saw it. If there's anything deeper about the watch itself and time, I didn't see it. But yeah, I definitely just read it as like, well, you've definitely been through one of the more arduous experiences of anybody's life. And you could pretty much call yourself a man at this point going forward. So here's a watch to make sure you're on time for shit.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, anyway, loved it. Thank you for pointing out this film to me. And now I can add it to my repertoire of films that I can talk about in party situations where I can act like a badass because I've seen Night of the Hunter.
Hell yeah. I'm down for any party where you're discussing Charles Laughton and Robert Mitchum. So.
Yeah, totally. Totally. I don't know what party that is because, like, you know, for whatever reason, I can't find people like you out here that really, really love films the way that I do. I'm sure they're out there. I guess I just need to go to a few parties, you know? I just need to stop hanging out on Zoom so much.
Hey man, that's where we're connecting. So not all bad. How is LA treating you right now? We had 75 and sunny here in Chicago yesterday, and then today it was 30 and gray. And so winter has officially started here. So.
Yeah, it sounds like Chicago to me. No, it's been good. Like 70, 75 during the day, like sun out, beautiful. I go for walks pretty much every day when I can get out. And then I've been reading a lot outside. And I haven't really been going too many places. However, on Saturday, I went to Orville Peck's Rodeo.
Hell yeah. How was
that? That was amazing. And he played a Rancid song, dude. I think I sent you that clip that I
put out. Yeah.
He played Olympia. And man, it was awesome. I was like,
yeah, you I saw that he was playing with a lot of different people. When I saw him last year, it was just him by himself.
Yeah, he's calling it like his rodeo. So I guess this is okay, like his nice. third annual. And so, yeah, he had some great support acts. And my girlfriend and I just enjoyed it. It's chilly out at night now, you know, like it can get into the 50s here. So like going to the Greek and outdoor show, you really got to like dress up. Saying that, because tomorrow I'm going to see Morrissey at the Greek.
Oh, love it.
Ooh, and you know me, Morrissey. I'm like insane freak fan of Morrissey for anybody out there. I can't help myself. Like, I just love that guy. I love everything about Morrissey. And so I'm going to see him tomorrow. It'll be like the 80th time I've seen Morrissey, and I can't wait.
I was going to say, is it actually 80? It's hyperbole. Okay.
No, it's probably like 15 or maybe close to 20, but not close to 20, probably but in the 15. That's probably, but it's getting there, you know.
If you were to pull fish numbers, you would get up those if that was possible for Morrissey. So yeah.
You know, the bummer about it is I got to wear like a snowsuit because at night out there and the, you know, it's elevated in the kind of in the mountain at the Greek Theater. So.
Oh yeah.
But yeah. Fun. I can't wait. How about you? What, you got anything cool going on?
Not much. Sticking with you went to see Cecily Strong Saturday.
Oh, so you saw the same show I saw here in LA?
No. You, I'm talking about you. I'm staying on you.
Yeah. I did. But that was a few weeks ago now. Did we not talk about that?
No, I haven't heard, because when you mentioned that, I ended up rewatching all of I Think You Should Leave, because she's got a great skit in the first season for that one, and it's still one of the best sketch shows of all time. So
yeah, I know you love that show, and I my girlfriend loves it too. I saw I think maybe one episode, but yeah, she was awesome. She's a badass. It was a I think it's a play that Lily Tomlin originally did. And it was at a cool theater that I had never been to before. So we were able to get a drink before we went in, and it was really nice and really kind of like small. And she like performed for like 2 hours, man. I was like, I don't know how she did it. Like she got like a lot of things to remember and a lot of stamina. But that's why she wasn't on Saturday Night Live for a little while, because she was doing that play. And yeah, I know my girlfriend really loved it. I thought it was great. You know, for me, I just like, things I don't really know too much about. I don't know too much about like improv and things like that. So I'm learning a lot. We're going to go see that Natalie Palamides do that Nate show here in LA in December. So I'm excited about it. I know I've told you I've seen her a few times. I don't think you're familiar with her, but Nate is on like Netflix if you want to check it out. That's pretty cool. I've seen her once before do a play at Beeskin. Natalie Palamides is her name.
You have mentioned it.
She's got a lot of, she's been doing a lot of commercials lately. She's now in the Progressive family. She'll like show up in those ones with John Hamm and stuff.
Okay, nice.
Yeah, she's cool. She's really like, she fucks with the audience a lot, you know? So you kind of have to like, I've learned, you know, don't wear like your best clothes because like, you're probably going to get like an egg whipped at you and shit. You know, it's one of those.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah, no, we saw, we went to see Maria Bamford here in Chicago earlier this year. And that was great. That was definitely one of the first comedy shows that I was able to go to after everything was opening up. The Den Theater in Chicago, which is great. And Maria, it's definitely pretty, I mean, if you know Maria Bamford, you're definitely familiar with her brand of comedy, but she's definitely good at incorporating the audience and bringing her awkwardness to them as well. So,
yeah. But I haven't really like watched too much, but if you want to to talk about movies, I've been kind of like, you know, trying to get everything like out of my system for October with all the horror movies that we were watching. And now moving into like getting a little time for music, I'm going to talk about my pick right now because that's what I've been doing more. So I've been trying to like segue into trying to listen to a lot more music. I actually been kind of into this guy, Chad Tepper, who I met out here. I took a few photos of him for some stuff he's doing. And I really love his music. He's up and coming, kind of like been around for a while, but he's got like a new stuff coming out. It's kind of like a mesh of like emo and punk, but like a little bit of like that rap flair and stuff. So I've been loving that. But aside from that, I've been just like crushing the new Meat Wave record. And especially the song that I'm going to pick for everybody to listen to is called "What Would You Like Me to Do" from their newest record, Malign Hex. And it's a band that I've talked about, I think, before with you, Pat, but they're from Logan Square. They're Logan Square, and I know you love Logan Square as a former resident of Logan Square yourself. Chances are you'd be going to those bars or wherever you go in Logan Square and probably see them. They're like, it's what I love the most about this band is that they really have that Chicago neighborhood flair to them. And it's really like, there's not kind of no bullshit on their social media. It's just like them, you know, and it's kind of like, we put out a song today and like, that's it. Like no like shtick, you know, it's like you get what you get. And every record is kind of like, you know, second verse, same as the first, like it's, you get their style. If you're into it, you're into it. This new record, Malign Hex, there's this one song called Ridiculous Car. And I honestly think they wrote it about like those assholes who drive their like Lamborghinis through 290 and like cut off people that are going like 90 miles. Listen to the lyrics of that song. Yeah, yeah. Like, literally about 290. And if you're from Chicago and you've ever driven down 290, you'll get it. But they have another song too, like where they say this lyric, man, they're like, man, in this, the song I want you to check out, which is called What Would You Like Me to Do? And they have this lyric that is just, I think you'll love. It's called, they say, man cave, you're a caveman. It's like, I love that, you know, nice. Like, it's like, there's stuff like that to pick out of these songs that I think you just really, really, really love. So anyway, What Would You Like Me to Do? Meat Wave on their new record, Malign Hex. Check it out. Chad Tepper, another up-and-coming artist that I think people will love, loving that right now. What's your picks?
Yeah. I mean, to stay on that, I'm definitely familiar with Meat Wave. Very good. I saw them at the Empty Bottle a couple years ago. It looks like they're playing the Empty Bottle tomorrow night. But
sold out.
Here in Chicago. But yeah, it looks like it's already sold out. So yeah, they definitely have gotten a much more traction lately. I mean, I'm only slightly familiar with them. I saw them the one time, but that was mostly it. And so yeah, I'm definitely down with that pick. Looks like they're playing in Milwaukee tonight. So if I'm feeling ambitious, maybe I'll just drive up to Milwaukee if I got
nothing else going on
later and watch the show. So
yeah.
No, that's great. I have not heard, I don't think I've heard that song. So I'm going to definitely check out.
I mean, there's a lot of like kind of fun working class stuff on there too. That just like, I love, like, again, it kind of makes you feel like that city in Chicago, people going out, you know, having a nice time and doing what they can, especially that song, Honest Living. There's a song called Honest Living. I make an honest living. You know, that's great lyrics to that too. So anyway.
Oh yeah.
On to your picks. I can't wait to hear what I'm going to be listening to this week.
Yeah, this is a newer discovery for me, even though it's an older band. The band, and I think I mentioned it to you recently, Helloween. The German power metal band from the 80s. Are you familiar with them? Have you?
There's a song I remember. It was like "Eagle Fly Free," right?
Boom! Yeah. That's a great song.
Yeah,
that's
Helloween.
I almost picked that one, and that's actually great. You should just listen to that song as well. But that wasn't the one I was going to. That would have been better if I had actually picked that one. So, no, that's great. I was familiar with this name of the band, and I knew they existed, but I certainly had never heard anything from them. And I came on to them through a podcast recently, actually. They were talking about this band and blown away by a couple of their 80s albums. But the song that I'm going with is Helloween by Helloween. So it's a 14-minute power metal song.
Oh, I know the song.
Yeah, and I promise you, it does not feel like 14 minutes because this thing fucking slaps. But yeah, no, I mean, that's just definitely what I've been really enjoying this week. And it was a complete coincidence. They are touring with Hammerfall, which is a Swedish metal band that I have known for a while and I do like quite a bit. Complete coincidence that they're touring. So I actually just picked up tickets for them in the spring. They're playing at the Riv here in Chicago. So very excited for that show. That's going to be wild. They definitely just have the power and speed metal vibe that doesn't take itself too seriously that I really fucking respond to, especially as of late. Apparently they are like stadium sellers. Like they sell out stadiums throughout the entire world except for America, which is common for a lot of metal bands. Actually, metal is just not quite as popular in America as like some other nations, and so they are constantly touring, like selling out stadiums all over the place, and then they come to America and they play moderate places like the Riv. And so I'm definitely excited for that, and that's not too far from my neighborhood. So, but yeah, Halloween from Halloween, would definitely recommend checking this song out. Certainly 14 of the best minutes you'll have today, and yeah, definitely enjoying that lately.
That's great, man. We were crushing that record when we were doing the Scissors, I think during the Viva times. And I remember somebody's dad or something like was like, you guys gotta check out Halloween, you know? And we're like, Halloween, that's a great name. And did not disappoint, that's for sure.
Which album was that?
I think it's the one you just talked about with the Eagle Fly Free song is on there.
Yeah, it's a double album, Keeper of the Seven Keys, part one and part two.
Keeper of the Seven Keys, yep.
So this was like 86 and 87. Keeper of the Seven Keys, part one and part two. Holy shit, these albums are fucking great.
I probably haven't listened to it since like 2005, so I'm glad you brought it up because I kind of forgot. So I'm gonna check it out today.
Yeah, that Eagle Fly Free, that's got a... that's got a spirituality to it in terms of just the type of speed metal that I fucking love. So
yeah,
it's just like so over the top and triumphant in the most perfect way. Yeah.
Got a little bit of that like darkness. Like I think the darkness probably had to be big fans of them, you know, like a little more theatrical.
Yeah, I could see that. Definitely. I mean, the theatrics were a part of it in the 80s, but that's what makes it so perfect and genuine re-listening to those 30-year-old albums now. So. No, it's great. I mean, now that I'm thinking about it, I love, because Viva's such a great record. Now I can hear the influence in it now, so.
Yeah. Well, cool, man. I mean, hey, look, Prince for sale at DarrenVorrell.com.
Hell yeah.
We got Meat Wave Malign Hex you should listen to. We got Halloween you should listen to. Check out Night of the Hunter, which is what this whole episode was about. Love both Patrick and I both love this movie. Robert Mitchum, terrifying, and Charles Laughton's only directed film. I hope you guys like it. As always, you know where to find us at remainderspod.com or at any of our social medias, which are connected to our website. We'd love to hear from you. Tell us what you thought of this film. I don't know. Tell your friends to take a look at the film and then maybe listen to the episode if you are so inclined.
Hell yeah. Always a pleasure talking with you, Darren. And as always, love always overcomes hate.
Love overcomes hate always. All right, Pat, we'll talk to you next week.
Talk to you, bud. See ya.
Yeah, man. Bye.